Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A shifting political coalition may help avert the potential collapse of Pakistan's government. More than 1,000 extra Marines will be deployed in southern Afghanistan, and cleric Muqtada al-Sadr returns to Iraq. Joining me for the International Hour of the Friday News Roundup, James Kitfield of National Journal Magazine, Susan Glazer of Foreign Policy Magazine, and Nadia Bilbasi of Middle East Broadcast Center TV. Do join us, 800-433-8850. We'll start taking your call a little later in the hour. In the meantime, you can send us an email, join us on Facebook, or send us a tweet. Good morning and Happy New Year to all of you.
Happy New
Good
Year.
Morning, Happy New Year.
James Kitfield, why are we sending more troops to Afghanistan now?
Well, because the president in his December review said that the strategy was basically working. They'd reversed the momentum of the Taliban in Kandahar and Helmand in the south, where it's basically its home base. But those progress was fragile and reversible, and this is an indication that they still fear it is reversible. The spring fighting season always picks up after the snows melt in the passes of between Afghanistan and Pakistan. They expect the Taliban to come back and try to retake or reinfiltrate into Kandahar, and they want to make sure that they can sustain this progress, keep them out from reinfiltrating back into Kandahar. The essential concern is there's a July 2011 deadline to begin withdrawing the surge troops. They are worried that if there is a reversal in the spring, the White House will say the strategy is not working. We should accelerate that withdrawal. They want to work against that, so they want some more troops.
Susan Glasser.
Well, I think that's an important point that James just made, because in a lot of ways, this is as much a Washington story at this point as it is what's happening on the ground. And I think the real struggle, in a way, is for the soul of President Obama. He's made it clear, and if you read the accounts of the internal deliberations, they want out. They don't want to be the president who's stuck in an endless quagmire in Afghanistan. I think there are some competing interests inside the Pentagon, and this may reflect a positioning that's going to come to a head later this year when it comes to, do we keep the surge going? Can President Obama find a meaningful way to say, we're getting out?
Not yet, Bilbasi.
But also, Diane, this number adds to the 30,000 troops that the president authorized. So we're not really adding new numbers if you consider the number that he authorized in December 2009. And these troops, and the Marines in particular, will go to the southern area of Afghanistan, to Helmand, to Kandahar. And maybe you have seen an example today of the killing of 17 civilians, mainly, because the Taliban were targeting one police officer by the name of Ramazan in this border area of Spin Boldak. And as a result, we have seen now that the situation is very fragile, can be reversed overnight, and therefore the gains that the Pentagon has secured, and they talked about it, it has to be solidified by adding these Marines. So there is a necessity for them in order for them to be able to withdraw, as the president said in July, coming the date that expected.
You know, General Petraeus talks a lot about putting time back on the clock. That's what he's been trying to do, to show enough progress. And this, again, the template, I always say it was Iraq, and because it's the same general and he's using the same template. He put time back and bought patience in Washington because he could show progress. If their fear is that they've shown that progress this fall, without doubt, they made that point in this review. President Obama conceded that point. But any reversal, you know, takes that time back off the clock. So they're very concerned that they continue to show a progression of positive progress in the spring leading up to July 2011.
But aren't they simply trying to show progress in the south while everything else in the north, for example, is going to hell?
Well, I think that is one of the big overlooked stories of last year, actually, was the significant deterioration and even encroaching Talibanization of the north of Afghanistan, which had never before, even when the Taliban nominally ruled the rest of the country, they really didn't have inroads there, and the Northern Alliance was using the north as a base to fight the Taliban. What you've seen is a combination of things. The lack of meaningful political progress and control over the North, certainly the U.S. and other forces not focusing their attention security-wise in the North. And so the result is that even areas of the country that haven't been focused on, just to go back to this point quickly on putting time back on the clock. It's a fairly audacious kind of spin. It certainly reflects General Petraeus playing the hand he's been dealt, but they want to say the clock began in 2010. And they want to do that for some very explicit political reasons to have a chance to quote unquote do it right. But let's be real here. You know, the clock actually started in September of 2001 on this war. And I understand, and it makes sense in a political context what the Pentagon is doing, but the clock did not start in 2010. And I just saw a senior Pentagon official quoted saying that the other day, and I thought, wow, that is such an interesting case of, you know, repositioning here.
You know, I take your point. It's a 10-year war. We're a very war-weary country, and so he's having to deal with that hand that he's been dealt. But for 9 of those years, it was an extremely under-resourced effort. Everyone knows this. We were focused on Iraq. We were absolutely drained all the resources out of Afghanistan. It was the most under-resourced peacekeeping operation probably in history. So in the sense that we've only had a year of actually having the proper resources in place to try to actually win this thing. So that would be Petraeus' argument. I think there's some substance to it.
And also why the South is because it is the stronghold of the Taliban. And I think from a military point of view, it's vital for them to clear these areas and to be able to hold them. So once they gain a territory, they have to be able to clean it, to return it to civilian rule, etc. So Taliban is focused in the Kandahar and the Helmand province, and therefore the Marines were vital for this particular area. And I agree with what you just said about the 9 years were neglected. So the administration, this administration, will say that we only starting 2 years, it's not a 10 years battle, and therefore we have to put the resources in the right place. We have to rebuild the country in terms of everything, development, military, fighting corruption, etc., because the focus was in Iraq.
The real stronghold, though, in a way, of the Taliban is in Pakistan next door, right? And that's, I think, part of the, you know, calculation we haven't talked about yet. And you look at what happened in Pakistan this week, and, you know, you really see another bad week for Pakistan, another bad day for Pakistan. You know, the country, on top of its incredible political woes, the enormous corruption, the long-term toleration of the Islamization, now it's an economic meltdown as well. And what have they chosen? They've chosen to buy a short-term, political restabilization at the cost of their international bailout package. And, you know, I don't even think we've begun to digest what this really means for Pakistan, that they have decided to not go ahead with a planned fueling increase that basically caused the turmoil over the last week in Pakistan. They've canceled that in defiance of the international economic community. And, they're headed for another big crisis.
That's true, but I mean, the Prime Minister Gilani was forced to do that. I mean, he took this step back after what happened in the last few days, considering the killing of the governor of the Punjab, who is the most populous and the most wealthiest provinces of all Pakistan. He's considered.
And what is the reason that people speculate he was killed?
All right. Well, Salman Taseer was killed basically because he criticized a law in Pakistan, which is a blasphemy law, which is basically, it came as a result of a Christian woman who criticized, allegedly said something about Prophet Muhammad. And he has been very outspoken against extremism, for tolerance, for minority rights, etc. The saddest thing and most significant is he was killed by one of his bodyguards. And even to put things into more complicated picture is the lawyers who are defending this guy has been seen as a hero. His name is Mumtaz Qadr. They throw rose petal on him in the court. These very lawyers who stood against General Musharraf in the past are defending him on pro bono. And the 500 clergy, very well-known clergy men in Pakistan, has supported him. And the problem now, people, liberals have been talking in Pakistan about anybody who is there to criticize these laws or to stand up to the extremists will be willing lemmings. So the choice now is between extremists and liberals, and that will weaken the government because the governor was very close friend of President Zardari. He's with the PPP activist, and he's well known. And the problem now is, where do you go from here? And that will tighten the government hands in terms of extremists to the degree that the government almost collapsed.
We've said on this program before that Pakistan remains the most dangerous place on earth. You know, it's got this confluence of this fight between Islamic extremists and a secular government. You have a fight between, you have nuclear weapons there, and you have Al-Qaeda on their territory. You have all these, this network of extremist groups. It's a very dangerous place, and there's a struggle going on for the future of Pakistan. One of the champions of a secular modern Pakistan just got assassinated. What worries me is this guy who killed him was expelled from the security forces 2 years earlier for his extreme religious views. How did he get back into a security detail like that? He shot the guy more than 20 times. He himself was not shot by any of the other bodyguards. So it leads me to wonder whether there's more of a conspiracy behind this and might be one of these extremist groups.
And does that suggest also that other opposition members might be targeted?
Well, remember the tragic assassination of Benazir Bhutto, which was only a few years ago. I think the message is crystal clear at this point. I was really struck by the fact that not only President Zardari, but, you know, many of the leading remaining moderate voices in Pakistani politics were too afraid to even attend his funeral. And I think that really is a metaphor to me that speaks to where Pakistan is at the moment.
I think Prime Minister Jilani was there, wasn't he?
He did attend. You know, this is where you have a state that you don't know exactly who's on your side. And I think that's what the Americans have been dealing with to their enormous frustration. Go take a spin through some of the WikiLeaks cables that have been released so far, and that picture will leap out pretty clearly at you, whether it comes to the sponsorship by the ISI, the Pakistani spy agency, of elements of both the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and other Islamic extremist groups. This is something that, you know, we don't know whose side they're on.
Susan Glasser, she's editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy Magazine. Do join us, 800-433-8850. And welcome back to the Friday News Roundup of International News, our first of the new year. This week with Nadia Bilbasi of Middle East Broadcast Center, Susan Glasser, she's editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy Magazine, James Kitfield is senior correspondent with National Journal Magazine. You can join us on 800-433-8850, your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. So we have an old friend coming back to Iraq from his so-called exile in Iran. What has prompted Muqtada al-Sadr to come back to Iraq, Susan?
Well, you know, after months and months and months of political uncertainty, you know, there's now the formation of a new government in Iraq. And I think you have a moment where we're going to see, actually, whether the Islamic parties in Iraq take the center stage again, whether they make a full throttle sort of challenge to steer the course of the new Iraq. And I'm curious to see what happens. He was greeted as almost a conquering hero in a way.
Yeah.
You know, this. I was actually in Iraq in 2004 with a unit that was given orders to capture or kill him, and that was rescinded. This guy is virulently anti-American. I think it's less an Islamic issue than a Shia versus Sunni issue. He's very closely allied with Iran. He's a Shia. He has this militia. But his militia was defeated twice by the Iraqi army, and it kind of went underground. And his party kind of joined the political process, and they won 40 seats. So he became a kingmaker in this last election. And he was able to throw his 40 seats in the coalition with Maliki. So Maliki, the former prime minister, is going to be the future prime minister. So he's a kingmaker, and that's why I think he returned. He saw that he's going to have, I think, 8 of the maybe 3 dozen ministries in the new government. So the time is ripe for him to sort of come back and play the political champion of his party. It can't bode. I mean, I can assure you the Americans and the United States is very worried about his ties to Iran. That's the bad news. The good news is if he's decisively decided to play politics, to try to exert influence through politics, that's probably something we can live with. It was when his militia was a Hezbollah-like armed group outside of politics that he was sort of public enemy number one to the Americans. But he's not doing that now, so we'll see.
Except that you worry whether it could lead to some sectarian violence.
It could, and I think the people who are worried most as well are the Sunnis, because don't forget that his army, Jaish al-Mahdi, has been responsible for some of the most grotesque, terrible massacres in 2006 and 2007. But you asked Diane why he returned. I think he returned because of the blessing of Iran. The day he returned to Najaf as a hero, as he said, he visited the grave of Imam Ali, and he was surrounded by all his supporters. And it coincided with the visit of the Iranian foreign minister, who the ambassador to Baghdad said that Muqtada Sadr is the stabilizing force in Iraq now. Also, he made peace with his old nemesis, which is Prime Minister Nour al-Maliki. Let's not forget that Maliki ordered the security forces to unleash a campaign against his Mahdi army in Basra and almost wiped them out. So he did not forget that. But because of this realliance with Iran, and I think he was given also an assurance that he's not going to be trial for a killing of another assassination of another Shiite leader, he was allowed to come back. Now, his self-imposed exile was for religious reasons. He went to Qom, which is the most revered religious Shiite city in Iran, to learn, because he wanted to be an Ayatollah. He did not reach that degree. He's coming back now, not as a firebrand, rebel, troublemaker, but a respected politician who has, as James said, he has 40 seats in parliament, and he might have influence. And I think he will give every reason for the Americans to be worried about. But I think his argument will be he will influence the Iraqi government in not keeping any American bases after the withdrawal of 2011. And it also demonstrates that Prime Minister Nour al-Maliki is showing some kind of independence from the Americans to allowing somebody who was so vehemently against the Americans to come back as a hero.
Well, I think that's the real point, right, that we'll all be looking at this year, is at what price did Maliki purchase, in effect, this renewed seat? You know, remember, this came after months and months and months of political stalemate. It was only broken by making what some people certainly here saw as a deal with the devil. This is the price of that deal. For now, they're talking reconciliation. For now, they're repositioning Sadr as a political leader and, you know, respected parliamentarian. What happens if Maliki doesn't do his bidding sufficiently, if Iran turns away, if he's too conciliatory toward the Sunnis? Then I think is when you face the renewed violence, not immediately,
yes,
but over the course of this year, you face that potential. And I'm glad you spotlighted this issue of the renewed American presence. Things have not worked out as the Americans anticipated they would after the quote-unquote withdrawal. They expected to maintain a very robust military presence inside Iraq for the foreseeable future. But in fact, you could see that this was not going to be the case, and that you may actually see almost no American military presence after the end of this year, which would be a big change.
Korea.
Yeah.
That is the thing to watch. There's two things to watch. Because he comes back into the government, do the Sunnis bolt? We haven't seen that yet. If they bolt from the government, that's very bad news, because that's the sectarian divide that almost plunged the country into civil war. Hasn't happened yet. Alawi's got also a lot of seats and ministries in this new government. So if the Sunnis stay as part of the political process, that'll be a good sign. If they bolt, bad sign. Also, the American base is an interesting point. We have 50,000 troops still in Iraq. Iraq. We did expect to negotiate a new status of forces agreement with Iraq, so there would be some residual U.S. presence there, because they don't have an army that can really defend its own borders, and they're in a pretty bad neighborhood. If all the Americans leave at the end, it certainly means that our strategic relationship with Iraq will be damaged. Mm. It means I don't expect that to happen, because we have a lot of leverage with them. They basically, their whole arsenal is now American weapons. They need our air force to they don't have their own air force. They don't have a navy. They don't. So basically, watch what happens with the American presence. If it goes down to zero, I take the point. It will be a blow to the strategic relationship.
All right, let's talk about Iran's snub. The United States in this so-called targeted invitation to view its nuclear power plants. They've invited Russia, China, members of the EU, and some other countries, right, but left out the United States.
Wow, snubbed by Iran. That's really a news line there. This happens a lot between us and Iran, and it wasn't just us. It was some members of the EU3 that have been pressing them on their nuclear program. This is the game Iran plays. We haven't actually, the Obama administration's been pretty successful at putting them in a tight sanctions box. We got Russia and China on board with that. The sanctions, by all measures, are starting to bite in ways that they're causing them a lot of economic pain. They had to devalue their currency recently. They're having a hard time with importing refined petroleum, even though they export the oil. They don't have a lot of refining capacity. And so they've come back to talks, but they've come back to talks on their nuclear program very reluctantly. There's going to be another round of talks in Turkey later this month. And this is the game Iran always plays to try to break off the coalition that is surrounding it. And, you know, I don't think it'll have much impact. Everyone has seen this trick before multiple times. No one's, I think, going to fall for this.
What about the American woman in Iran who was arrested for spying, Nadia?
Well, this woman is a 55-year-old woman that was trying to cross to Iran from Armenia. The Iranian press agencies were saying in the beginning that was arrested because her visa was not in order. And then they denied the official government response. Well, they denied that they have it. They have her. They're saying that actually we sent her back. The State Department now is asking the Swiss embassy in Tehran, because they are the one who are looking after the American interest, to find out if she actually been arrested or not. Most likely, my guess is she will be arrested, because this is very close to the negotiation. They would love to have a Westerner and American in their hand. And as we get closer to the negotiation in Istanbul that's happening end of this month, you know, I mean, why these people go to Tehran, to Iran, I don't know, especially from places like Armenia and elsewhere. But they're saying that she was a spy. I mean, the usual thing. And she, what's interesting, they said that she has a spying equipment in her teeth. And that's the official Iranian kind
She's
of story.
She's the fourth American arrested for spying in Iran in 2 years.
Well, that's right. Remember, we're talking about the hikers who came in from Turkey. And, of course, that was a big ordeal that involved negotiations from many different countries, and not only the United States, to try to get them back. It's become a standard part of the arsenal of the Iranians in dealing with this game that really does involve the nuclear high-stakes poker. You know, the Europeans, of course, haven't fallen for this. They're saying they're not going to attend this sort of dog and pony inspection show. I think the real targets are Russia and China. That was a big blow to the Iranians last year when the Russians and the Chinese sided with the Americans at the UN Security Council and went along with the sanctions. And I think you're going to see a lot of focus of their diplomacy, particularly on the Chinese. I think they were really surprised by that. There had been pretty firm indications that the Russians were moving in this direction of working with the Americans on the sanctions. So perhaps that was less of a surprise. But I would look to see a focus of the Iranian diplomacy this year on peeling away the Chinese from the UN support for sanctions.
James.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, we've seen this game. We had the American woman who was an academic in this town who was also accused of spies, eventually let go. I mean, they trump up these spy charges and they use them as pawns in this game. And I take Nadia's point. Anyone with an American passport, if you're not on official business, should not travel to Iran, because
why
you will become.
Are they doing
I have no clue, but they shouldn't do it. They become pawns, and it really does complicate our own diplomacy, because we're at this one time trying to, you know, put pressure on Iran to come clean about its nuclear program. At the same time, we're having to ask a favor of Iran to release these people, and it really does complicate diplomacy.
And turning to Egypt, Nadia Bilbasi, was Al Qaeda behind the bombing of a Christian church in Egypt,
so
in
far,
Alexandria.
In Alexandria, absolutely. So far, it has the modus operandi of Al-Qaeda or an affiliate of Al-Qaeda. The explosive so far seems to be too sophisticated for a local maid that they think it's coming actually from Iraq. And they haven't determined, the Egyptian security forces, whether it actually it is Al-Qaeda or a Salafi group that affiliated to it. But this is the first attack ever on a church in Egypt. There have been tension between Christians and Muslims, the Copts and the Muslims, normally over land, over a church, over a woman converted to Islam or vice versa. But this is the first time we've seen Al-Qaeda targeting Christians in Iraq. We have seen the attack in October where 40 people were killed. Now in Alexandria where 20 people were killed, including Muslims as well. And I think it shows the insanity of groups like this who are targeting people in worship places. And I'm glad to know that there's so much outrage in the Arab world. So many people spoke out against it, including the Mufti of Saudi Arabia, talking about these people do not represent Islam, that they hijack in the religion. And it's good to hear it because now the Christians in the Middle East are under attack. You know, I mean, we're talking about in Iraq, for example, before the American invasion, you had almost 1 million Christian in Iraq. Now it's under 500,000. It's the same in most other countries. And Christians in all over the Middle East have been integral part of the mosaic, and now to see them leaving it, they enrich the culture. I mean, just to give you an example of in Palestine, they've been leaders of the national movement for independence. And when in the 1970s, three of top PLO leaders, Palestine Liberation Organization, were killed in Beirut by the Israelis, they took them to bury them in a church. And people were surprised why they were buried in the church, because they didn't know they were Christians. This question of being Muslim or Christian was never a part of any question. But now the Al-Qaeda is playing on this tension, and it's so sad to see it.
Nadia Bilbasi, Middle East Broadcast Center. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. So, James, as you look at this attack, what does it mean or could it mean for the stability of religion in Egypt?
Well, I was heartened to see the Egyptian government take this extremely seriously. They have taken the military and put it around all the Christian churches now, apparently, because they just celebrated their Orthodox Christmas. But we know, for instance, that Al-Qaeda, or there's Islamic extremist groups, have a pretty big footprint in Egypt. The number two in Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is an Egyptian, formerly with the Muslim Brotherhood. There is an extremist element there, but they have been pretty much kept under the boot heel of the Egyptian government. So I suspect they'll take this very seriously. But I mean, this is their modus operandi. We saw them in bombing the Golden Mosque in Iraq. You know, then it was Sunni versus Shia. They like to sort of antagonize these religious divides to try to create violence and instability.
But the bottom line is Egypt has a lot of conditions that might suggest it's ripe for some kind of further political and even sectarian violence, instability. You have an octogenarian president who's ruled Egypt with a very, very heavy hand for the last three decades. There's a crucial turning point coming up later this year. We don't know yet for sure whether President Hosni Mubarak is going to position himself for re-election again or not. Some people are already speculating that this means that he will try to remain in power in order to potentially crack down even further. Almost certainly that is what the groups that sponsored this attack on the church in Egypt were looking for. They were looking for further hasty, overbearing crackdowns by the Egyptian government in the effort to provoke the kind of violence and conflict inside the society.
And about presidents wanting to stay in power. The Obama administration is putting new sanctions, trying to put pressure on Ivory Coast president to cede power, Susan.
Well, that's right. This has been one of those creeping over the holidays stories that really hasn't on some level got the attention that it might deserve. What you have is a pretty extraordinary situation. You have a president of Ivory Coast who lost an election. There's been the absolutely unanimous viewpoint of the international community that he should go. He's refusing to do so. It's basically a standoff. No one knows, short of the use of force, which the international community is not yet willing to take this kind of a measure, what's going to happen. It's a real test of the international order in the Obama era, right? This is how these tragedies can often occur. We're focused on the war in Afghanistan. We're talking about potential instability in Egypt, one of the crucial countries in the Middle East. All of a sudden, you have offstage in an African country that's not in the center of attention a complete standoff, what's the world going to do about it,
James?
Well, I mean, that's a pretty good summary of what's going on there. And I think, you know, we also have the issue of Sudan. So we've got multiple places where our attention is divided. And this guy is, like many African autocrats, decides he likes power and wants to hold on to it. We've seen that game played many, many times all over Africa. And I don't think it's likely the international community can summon the will to intervene militarily. So it comes down, and we have an African delegation that went there and tried to convince him and gave him offers of exile, et cetera. He didn't take those. So, like I said, it's a standoff, but we've seen this before. It's a sad commentary about the state of democracy in Africa.
Yeah, let me just, before I come to Ivory Coast, I will say that Zawahiri was part of the Islamic Jihad, not the Muslim Brotherhood, and actually the Muslim Brotherhood condemned the attack in Alexandria. Côte d'Ivoire, I mean, the problem here is it's a classic example of what you see, a repeated scenario. We've seen it in Zimbabwe. Now you have President Laurent Gbagbo refuse to admit the results. The winner of the opposition, Alhassan Ouattara, was considered the winner by everybody, including the United States and France. You have now a terrible situation where you have mass graves of 200 people dead. He wanted to stay in power. The African Union doesn't want to use military options to oust him out. And the problem is he decided to stay there at the expense of more people getting killed.
Nadia Bill Basie of Middle East Broadcast Center. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. By MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition, on the web at metlife.org. By the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting unconventional approaches to transform health and health care at rwjf.org/pioneer. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Will Ferrell and director-writer Adam McKay talk about making their comedy The Other Guys, which has just come out on DVD. It's a spoof of cop action films, their car chases, explosions, and witty retorts. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. We'll open the phones now first to Rochester, New York. Boa, good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. Quick comment. Good panel. It amazes me how the international community usually approach the problem. Usually the U.S., we tend to present ourselves as good power brokers, but yet, when things come, we end up in the wrong part of the thing. Without taking sides, I'm an African and I'm not from Côte d'Ivoire, but I have friends in both sides who have said that there were serious violations, serious fraud in the election, both in the northern part controlled by Ouattara, where his rebel controls, because the gain of the actual sitting president was so low that anybody who knows the area will not believe it.
Now, I have heard these comments many times in some of the emails that we've had that the UN has taken the wrong position on this election. What do you hear, Nadia?
Well, I heard that the UN, the US, the former colonial power, which is France, both of them and the African Union believed that Alhassan Ouattara was the winner of this election. And President Gbagbo refused to accept it, and therefore he went and appointed his own commission to validate his own results. As a result now, if you see, Alhassan Ouattara is surrounded in a hotel in Abidjan by forces of the government, and he's not allowed to move out. And there was talk about a gross violation of the security forces that carried against people in the streets. We have talked about 200 dead. They talked about mass graves of 80 people dumped in one grave. They talk about even genocide. The Côte d'Ivoire ambassador to the UN talked about a genocide now, that people go and mark houses belonging to this or that tribe. And I mean, it sounds like a Rwanda scenario again. So the situation is extremely tense, and we obviously the United States and France has to do something, but so far they have failed to do anything.
Susan.
Well, that's right. In many ways, it appears from a great distance, which is what we're at, that the original crisis over the election has now grown into a much bigger crisis subsequent to it. So, of course, there may well have been significant violations on both sides in the actual conduct of the election. We're now in a very different phase from that. Whether rightly or wrongly, the international community has been unanimous in picking a winner in the election who is, as Nadia said, a guy surrounded in a hotel and unable even to leave. There are killings. There's a sense that Ivory Coast is now teetering on the brink of yet another civil war in a way that perhaps really has far outgrown the question of who exactly won the election and how fair was it.
My only point is, I mean, having witnessed a number of these elections in third world countries where the international community comes in as observers, et cetera, they're pretty cautious. And when you see the international community unanimously say, definitely this guy won, it leads me to believe, I mean, I've seen this play out before. It leads me to believe they have pretty good evidence that the opposition figure won.
Thanks for your call, Bo. Let's go to Hal, who's in Washington, D.C. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I believe one of your commentators said that for the first 9 years, we underfunded the war in Afghanistan. Would any of your commentators go so far as to say that during those 9 years, the Bush administration failed in its responsibility to conduct that war in a reasonable manner?
James.
Well, I've had senior members of the Bush administration admit to me that basically they were in a sort of holding action in Afghanistan because Iraq was such a disaster, required more than 150,000 troops at its peak. Intelligence services and special forces, all the enablers that were drained out of Afghanistan. So yes, they any commentator who's looked at what happened in Afghanistan will tell you that we in 2003 when we invaded Iraq started to really under-resource that effort. And I think the Bush administration would admit it themselves. They thought Iraq would be a lot easier than it turned out to be, and they didn't plan on doing that. But we've seen the heroic effort we've had to already put our service members through in terms of number of deployments just to do what we did. And that was much too little in the case of Afghanistan.
You know, I do agree with that analysis, and that there clearly was a window of time that was simply missed because of the destruction of Iraq. The only point, though, that I would make in addition that goes against this is to say, more money doesn't necessarily translate into more success in a situation like Afghanistan. And that exactly is the tragedy of the place. And if you look at the Soviet example, they also fought a decade-long war in Afghanistan, after all, pouring superpower resources of money and troops into both the civilian and the military fight in Afghanistan does not necessarily translate into quote-unquote winning a conflict. Mm-hmm. In many ways, it can fuel the conflict and to create more of the cycle of instability and chaos that we've seen in Afghanistan. So I think that's the terrible conundrum that we're here in right now. And even General Petraeus, I'm sure, would agree with the idea that, you know, there's not a one-to-one calculus. Give me X more money and I'll produce a victory for you. Unfortunately, that's not the case in Afghanistan.
All right, to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Good morning, Ethel.
Good morning. I have heard that the efforts of the United States to pressure Pakistan into taking stronger action against the Taliban and support the efforts of the U.S. in fighting the Taliban is actually destabilizing Pakistan, and that stronger action on the part of their government against the Taliban there could actually lead to the destabilization of Pakistan, which would be a more dangerous situation than that which exists in Afghanistan.
Nadia.
I'm not quite sure about that. I mean, when the Pakistani government felt that they were threatened by the Pakistani Taliban, they were willing to take action against them, as we have seen in the Swat Valley and elsewhere. The problem always remained of how they wanted to use the Afghani Taliban. Whenever it suits them, they can open the border, allow them to go and come back. We know about the ISI and how they've been using the Afghani Taliban for their own purposes. I don't know if they act against the safe havens in northern Waziristan, and this has always been the demand by the U.S. government, whether it's going to destabilize the Pakistani government or not. I'm not quite sure about this argument.
It's the argument that the Pakistanis actually make to us, and it gets to the, as usual, your listeners are a very smart lot. She put her finger on the catch-22 of our policy with Pakistan. We're trying to pressure it to take actions against the Taliban, but not to the point where it actually destabilizes the government, because that's the scariest scenario, especially because they have that nuclear weapon arsenal. So we're always trying to get them to do just enough, but not so much that it inflames all the extremist groups inside their territory.
All right. Thanks for calling, Ethel. And to Hollywood, Florida. Hi there, Jack.
Hi. Good morning to you all. Just a couple of quick points. First, I just want to mention that everybody's making this last incident, New Year's incident in Egypt, as if it's an isolated incident. In Egypt, Muslims have been committing violence against Christians for decades, rape, burning their churches, not allowing people to build new churches or renovate old churches. The government's really not helping them out. And this incident just got the media attention. Everybody's talking about that. But for decades, Christians have been suffering in Egypt. Second point I want to make, that the average person in any religion does not fully understand his religion, except for the clergy and their students. Now, in Islam, most Muslims believe that the religion is peaceful, and they only hear the early moderate verses of Quran, but they don't really read and understand the remaining, like, late verses that came late towards the era of strength in Islam, when Islam became strong. And those verses are full of violence against Christians, actually requesting Muslims to kill Christians and Jews until they decide to pay them taxes, special taxes for protection. And these groups like Hamas and all these other groups, the terrorist groups, are actually going by their religion to the T. They're not extremists. There's no extremism. This is their teaching.
All right. Thanks for your call, Susan.
Well, I think we got a little bit of a sense there of the passions that are inflaming this discussion in not just Egypt, but across the Middle East. It's a sad story, really. I think it is true that there's a history of low-level sectarian violence in Egypt and across all the countries in this region. Pakistan is another example, actually, where not only Christians but Shiite Muslims have been targeted. The broader question that we discussed earlier, which I think is really the relevant one here, is are we looking at a new campaign by al-Qaeda and its affiliates to destabilize Egypt and to bring this into a scale of conflict that we have not seen up until now?
Let's talk about these elections coming up this weekend in Sudan and exactly what could happen from your perspective, James.
I actually think this is the diplomatic dog that might not bark, and that would be a very good news story. In 2005, the deal that was brokered to stop a civil war that killed 2 million people had this referendum in it, that the South would be able to vote if it wanted to succeed. That vote comes on Sunday. 2 months ago when I was at the UN, the UN Secretary General was very worried that that would lead to genocide and civil war, a renewed civil war. The president of Sudan, Bashir, recently went to the South in the past week and said, I will respect the referendum, and if you vote to succeed. I will actually even help you stand up your government. Very conciliatory comments from him. I think the Obama administration gets a lot of credit for a very difficult diplomatic trick, which is dealing with this guy for the past year to get him to this point, even though he's been charged with war crimes by the International Criminal Court. A lot of people said we should just, you know, use sanctions and try to squeeze him. They actually reached out and tried to cut deals with him, and I think this shows that maybe one of those deals came through.
After Sunday, we might see the birth of the newest country in Africa. It will be the 54th state, which is the southern independent Southern Sudan. Most likely that this referendum will lead to independence. For the Southerners, it's a question of identity. They have been oppressed for so long by the Northerners, and therefore, for them, it's a question of seeking their own identity. The war that killed, as you said, 2 million people as a result of the actual war of the famine has led to so much of turmoil in the south. But this state will have so much challenges, regardless even if the north stayed calm and did not interfere and there was no violence. It might be one of the poorest states. They have no infrastructure. It is, I mean, on my reporting from Southern Sudan over the years, I haven't seen a least developed place on earth that I have seen it in Southern Sudan. And therefore, it's going to be, for them, it's emotional, it's euphoric to have your own state. But there is so many questions about citizenship, about the northerners who live in the up in Khartoum and has to come, and vice versa, about the oil resources that they have to fight about. And I think we're going to see two emerging powers fighting in Southern Sudan, the United States and China. Watch that.
Interesting. Here's an email from Mohammed in Alexandria who says, Sudan was never a nation. It's a faux state with borders drawn by the British colonial office in the late 1900s. The new Southern Sudan has the same multi-ethnic problems and will have the same instability as neighboring Uganda, Kenya, and Rwanda.
Yeah, I think this is a very important point. It might not be the explosive flashpoint on election day that there was a real panic about over the last year. And in that sense, James is right, that would be the sort of sky is falling scenario that might not happen. I think it's over the coming months and years when you look at A, can they really build a state out of almost nothing? And B, will they be sort of rift from within from the very beginning of this new nation?
Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy Magazine. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email from Pierre who says, your guests are totally uninformed about what's going on in Ivory Coast and continue to repeat what France and the U.S. want everybody to hear. Your guests need to listen to the other side. The AU is under pressure by France. Susan.
I think that's correct. There is enormous pressure by France, the United States, and the United Nations to come to a solution here. And I wouldn't pretend to have a clear understanding of what did play out in the election itself in Ivory Coast. And that's the tragedy of the situation, I think, that we're looking at, which is to say you have a standoff and an impasse. And that's what the international community is looking at right now. I don't think anybody is focused in the U.S. State Department trying to relitigate what happened in the election. What they're trying to avoid is the prospect of a serious new conflict in a country that can really not afford it.
James.
Well, I agree with that. And I'm not sure what the listener knows that he's not telling us. But again, it's not my experience that the United Nations, international observers, the United States, the African Union all come into in place and pick a side because they have some nefarious agenda.
It's a matter of trust, isn't it, James?
Well, it is a matter of trust. And obviously this listener doesn't trust that grouping of people. But it's been my relation. I don't know what he knows that makes him trust the leader who won't give up power.
But let me also add that the irony of it, that the envoy of the AU, the African Union, is the Prime Minister of Kenya, Raila Odinga. And this very person who was quarreled with President Kibaki after 1,500 people were dead in Kenya, that they managed to share power. And he's the one who's going to negotiate of how President Gbagbo and Alhassan Ouattara is going to share power if they come to that agreement. So even the AU is stuck in terms of options, and they don't want to use a military option.
Sounds like a pretty terrible situation. Do you expect Gbagbo to give up power anytime soon?
Well, we have seen it with President Mugabe of Zimbabwe.
No.
I do
you
not
really
think
do
he's going to
relinquish
Short
power.
Answer, no, right? He's got the troops. He's got the other guys surrounded. And no one in the international community wants to embark on another war.
Yeah.
They're busy.
So you're saying that this standoff is just going to continue indefinitely?
It looks like it could.
Wow. Well,
I don't know about indefinitely. I think something will happen eventually, whether Al-Hassan Ouattara will give up and or whether he will be persuaded to go into exile. It depends on how many people dies. As I said, in Kenya, it was 1,500 people before we reach an agreement. And unfortunately, it is the number of the civilians who are going to pay a price for politicians who decided to stay in power because of power is seductive and they wanted to stay as long as they can.
And I'm sure it also depends on how much money they're willing to give this president who's been defeated.
Look at what's happened in Somalia. Can a standoff occur indefinitely despite the overwhelming consensus and will of the international community? When the African Union is involved and there are no other significant international tools to bring to bear, the answer is yes.
Absolutely. I think Mugabe is actually the exhibit A. I mean, if these guys who have the power don't relinquish it and there's not enough of a strategic interest for the international community to commit force, they stay in power.
Yeah.
James Kitfield of National Journal Magazine, Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy Magazine, Nadia Bill Basie of Middle East Broadcast Center. Thank you all so much. Happy New Year.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.